Hello, everyone. Podcasting from beautiful San Diego, this is the BD Biosciences Facts Matter podcast series. I am your host, Aaron Tishnick, an immunologist and flow junkie. This show features casual conversations with researchers on the latest flow cytometry topics. Today, my guest is Dr. Ryan Brinkman. Ryan is a professor in the University of British Columbia Department of Medical Genetics, an associate faculty member of the Bioinformatics Center, and something that I always think is great to see a distinguished scientist of Terry Fox Laboratory. In this podcast, we'll attempt to cover computation analysis, approaches, challenges, and possibly what the future may look like for big data analysis. I know that's a lot to cover, but we'll see how we do. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, maybe we can just first start out with a background question that I'm sure has a very interesting answer, as I kind of know where you come from a little bit. How did you get into flow cytometry?
So I walked into the cancer agency looking for a job, and there was all these people doing this thing. I didn't know what flow cytometry was. This is back about 14 years ago. And I was like, well, what is this? And he said, well, this is flow cytometry, and we're doing analysis. And I looked at what these people are doing, and my background is bioinformatics, and it's like, oh my God, really? why? And that started my journey, trying to help people not do that.
Yeah. And I think, the challenges that you're kind of referring to, or the thing that you probably walked into, is we have very complex data sets. I mean, originally we started out with two or three parameters that we wanted to look at. And even then there was, you even bring it up that there was a note that this was going to be challenging because the complexity was going to increase. And here we are in the space of up to 30 parameters for cytometry. And now combining that with single cell multi-omics approaches. And we like to use these gates to kind of find populations. We say it's positive for marker A. We work our way to the next. And I think I'm kind of curious. I mean, what is it that you saw about that, and how did you think that you could maybe help with that challenge that people are facing?
Yeah. So anytime humans are doing highly repetitive tasks in front of a computer, it just kind of screams automation, because you're sitting in front of these boxes that can do really, really, really powerful things, especially things that are repeated again and again and again. And that was, to me, that's the gating process. It's like, here's another sample, and you're trying to draw these boxes around dots. And like you said, it's 30 or more dimensional data. And humans are looking at this on a two-dimensional screen. That's just the way we work and the interfaces that we have. But the data is so much more complex. And these boxes that people are doing the gating on, they're not stuck thinking in two dimensions. They can really, if you will, imagine data, what it really looks like in 30 dimensions, and find these patterns in 30 or more dimensions in ways that we just don't have the time or the ability or the inclination of where to look. You know, we're doing gating for a couple different reasons. We have some cell populations we want to find. That's a really repetitive task. You know, find this T cell population again and again and again and again and again in the same way. Well, we can automate that. And then if you're trying to do discovery, well, you're trying to find these populations that you may not have thought of that are there in the three-dimensional space, and you don't know how to get to them. Well, the computer can just look at all 30 dimensions at once. And that's what really attracted me, is seeing the possibilities for solving both of these problems is something that computers are really good at. People using the computers are just using it. It seemed to me that they were using it in the wrong way.
Yeah, you know, I guess, there's two things that you really hit on there. And one of them, the first one is, looking at things in two dimensions. You know, I've played with cytometers. I like to tinker around, and you can look through this little microscope and you can see where a laser beam is intercepting a flow stream. And we're really good at, like, as you adjust it, you see when it gets brighter and when it gets dimmer. And it just kind of tells you something about, the human eye, and we're good at catching patterns, right? Like we can see them over and over. And, you know, when we think about data analysis and using automation, like, there's always a challenge of why, if we're so good at seeing that pattern, like a pathologist analyzing samples or something like that, how do we trust a computer? How do we know that it's doing the right thing? Like, obviously there's data out there that's probably showing that this works. I mean, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, trust is a big issue in any kind of relationship, and so we have trust that an algorithm is doing what we know we can do really well because we've been doing it for so long. This is the whole problem, you know, 14 years ago. There was no adoption of the algorithms that are out there because there was no trust in them, because you would get these cases where it just doesn't work. It's just they weren't good enough. They would fail. And when we're doing clinical or if we're doing any samples, and especially clinical work, if something fails, there's really big detrimental outcomes as a result of that. And so, until you can get around this failure occurring, there's never going to be adoption. And it's taken a long time to get to that point. And you know, if people have been following this field, you know, the early stuff, it sucked. It really did. And it's really been in only, I think, the last couple of years that the field has really progressed enough on the algorithm side that the results that you can get are pretty much at the stage, if you look in the peer-reviewed literature, that they can replicate what people have done by hand. And it's a challenge to show that they've done better, because we set the gold standard as the manual gating. And anytime there's a difference, that's you have to go through all those differences one by one by one to show that, you know, what's actually happened here. But I think there's enough studies out, at least there's an accumulation of studies now in the literature that have shown that, yes, you know, for this case and this case and this case and this case, it's worked. And I think that the more that this happens, that the more people are going to be aware of it by going, you know, by seeing these papers. And then, you know, you get enough of this happening, I think that you build up, trust has something that has to be built up over time, both in relationships and with algorithms, right? And so as people become more comfortable with these and see this in the peer reviewed literature again and again, I think people are going to be more inclined to try that themselves.
Yeah, and I think as you mentioned, I mean, it comes to trust. And then I guess, honestly, that then lends towards like standardization. You need to provide a consistent, reliable data going in, and then you know, these algorithms probably have in this particular situation maybe a training set that it works from. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So I mean, good algorithms are never going to help bad data. That's certainly true. And the same way that anything you do to improve your data to get better manual gating results is just going to help the automated gating results the same way. You know, I think that you just answered that question. You know, good data is going to help everything, especially automated analysis.
So when I think about these tools, though, because there's two points that you brought up earlier. One was more for auto gating and trusting algorithms to find populations, but then also the dimensionality and how deep the data can go. We can't, mm-hmm. at least I can't. I don't know about other people. I can't wrap my head billions of dimensions based on the complexity of the data set, right? Like I can think in a couple mm-hmm. dimensions deep, but trying to think of all the possibilities of expression of markers to be able to process through that data. And then that kind of leads into a different set of tools, right?
Yeah, and I see that. And I think that's where we've seen some of the adoption of tools really take off, is when you start getting to that, you know, CyTOF and Symphony level of cytometry data, it just becomes too complex to do that kind of discovery work. And that, I think, then is when, you know, people realize, hey, we really do need automation to help, which has been the opposite case for so long, that, you know, we were okay with one-dimensional flow and two and three and four, you know, we got that, and it wasn't that hard. And so it's really been only in the last couple of years where there's been this intersection with the algorithms being much better and the data just becoming too much, that both for discovery and for even just the gating side of things. You know, when you have a 10,000-patient clinical trial, that also becomes a dimension problem when you look at how much time is going to be spent on that and the time it takes from, you know, when the data comes off the machine to when you actually get a reportable. That kind of time dimension also becomes too much for people to handle. And so there's the pain point that is also there. There's the trust in having the tools and the pain point that actually you have to figure out a different way to do it because the pain is just becoming too much.
Yeah, so I guess that then leads me into how you kind of think you see these tools becoming more commonplace. I can give you an example. As I was a postdoc, I was studying natural killer T cell responses to viral infections. So I would have a standard panel that I would use each day, day in, day out. I would be doing serial analysis of my particular cell populations, NK T cells responding to whatever infectious model I was using. And the data was very reproducible and very consistent. But then one random day, I decided I want to also then, so in that place, I could probably have a set of tools that would help me with my analysis for kind of a longitudinal study. But then I need to at some point decide, hey, you know, I want to do a little exploration, and I decide to make a very complicated panel with many, many parameters, and now I have a very, very complicated data set. How as a researcher, where I'm a postdoc or even a grad student, is that kind of the future where we kind of find tool sets and guide the researcher because it's different questions so that I choose the right ones?
Yeah, you need to have the right tool for the right job, and you just can't assume that, hey, I'm going to do automated flow cytometry data analysis, and this is the one tool I'm going to use. It's saying, like, I'm going to build a house, and I'm going to use a hammer. It's not going to work, and it really depends on what kind of house you're building and how fancy do you want it to look and what kind of tools, and then maybe what kind of people do you want to have involved with that. It might be that there's different expertise that's involved, and, you know, some people are good at computer science, some people are good at biology. Do we expect people to be experts at both? You know, should the people who are really good at generating that data maybe be the same people who are analyzing that data? And is there a line that says, hey, maybe we need a different skill set? And that may be involved in different people, because, you know, it both are really complex tasks, and there might be a cause for a division in labor across individuals, maybe.
You know, that's an interesting idea, because I know when we started getting into genomic analysis and we would have various array data sets come in and so forth, we, as immunologists, quickly realized we needed bioinformatics people, and that those are skills that we aren't necessarily going to pick up. And maybe that's kind of the direction that this is going to move, where there's a division of labor. And you can't be an expert in everything, but hopefully you have enough knowledge to be able to maybe ask the right question and find the right people to help.
Mm-hmm. And then be able to understand when the other side, and this goes both ways, when the other side is making mistakes, right? It can, you know, it's very different languages spoken by these two groups, and signals can get crossed. And if the biologists don't understand what bioinformaticians are doing and what kind of data they're producing and what that actually means, it can go very wrong. In the same way that if the bioinformaticians don't understand what happened on the to get that data and how it's produced and what these different there has to be some, you have to be at least conversant on understanding what's the right tool for the right job on both sides of that equation. So it's not enough to separate between the two, but, you know, you have to know what each side is doing when you're trying to put these two people in the room.
Yeah, and I guess we just need a lot more of you out there, because I feel the work you do kind of bridges that gap, and it's certainly one of the reasons that we've basically wanted to have a conversation with you, because this is certainly where I think the future of flow cytometry and data analysis is going to go. And we all need to kind of understand and start thinking about, well, what does that look like? And the pipelines of both facilities and capabilities and analysis to have all of these kind of in place at various locations, to be able to make sure that you're asking the right question, using the right tool, and then getting the correct answer, and really driving the science forward.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I think you made a good point with the what we can learn from other groups, other fields that have adopted this, and the challenges that they face. You know, they're years ahead of us because they had this problem years sooner. But I think we're getting there within flow cytometry.
Well, I see that we're kind of running low on time here, so I'm going to leave you with a question that is going to put you on the spot, and it's going to be like, wow, Aaron, you should have probably brought that up a little earlier. What do you want your lasting legacy to be when it comes to science and research and what you've been doing? Like, what do you want to be known for, and that people are like, you know, Ryan did that?
Wow, that's a tough, that's a good one. seeing I'm a distinguished scientist, I guess I've been around for a while. Maybe I'm just old, you know. So I guess I was fortunate enough to be around at the right time to be able to contribute to some of the early work setting up flow cytometry to be reproducible science. I think the pieces are largely in place now with data and metadata standards and work in repositories that have been done and algorithms have been done. And I think seeing these becoming adopted in big pharma really gives me the hope that this will trickle down through the field, and this will, I think, will raise up the technology across all the areas of science where it's being used, from research labs to clinical labs to patient care. And if that happens, you know, in 5 to 10 years from now, if there's no more gating being done by anyone anywhere, that's going to be an awesome thing. And I just was really lucky to be at the right place to help, you know, set that path forward. And it's going to be great to see that hopefully one day come through.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It was great chatting with you.
If you are interested in learning more about flow cytometry or would like to speak to a flow cytometry expert, please visit bdbiosciences.com. Ciao.